Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, August 21st, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. Let's get right into the headlines. Findings in a new firearm report could give prosecutors enough evidence to refile charges against Alec Baldwin in the deadly Rust movie set shooting. Prosecutors dropped an involuntary manslaughter charge against Baldwin at the time, believing the gun may have been modified before the shooting, causing it to malfunction. But a new analysis shows the gun was not modified before it fired on set, killing cinematographer Helena Hutchins. The report also includes still frames from videos sent to experts showing Baldwin, quote, with his right index finger ending up on or near the trigger, end quote. Prosecutors dismissed Baldwin's original charges without prejudice, meaning they could be refiled at any time. A new report from federal investigators shows the pilot in a deadly 2021 hot air balloon crash was using drugs, which may have impaired him before he flew into power lines on Albuquerque's west side. The pilot, Nick Molesky, and four passengers were killed. According to the report from the National Transportation Safety Board, Molesky had used cannabis within the last few hours before the crash and had also recently used cocaine. Molesky crashed the balloon when he failed to clear power lines while trying to land. Investigators didn't find any mechanical malfunctions or failures in the balloon. The June 2021 crash is the deadliest in New Mexico's long history of hot air ballooning. The Albuquerque Journal went through court records and found victims' families have filed at least two wrongful death lawsuits against Molesky, who at the time was working for Hot Air Balloonatics, LLC, and Sventato, LLC. An attorney in one of those lawsuits told the Journal they settled for $100,000, the maximum available amount from the balloon company's insurance. The status of the other lawsuit is unclear. A federal judge is forcing a change in New Mexico's campaign finance laws, striking down the state's limit on political party contributions to candidates and local parties. Chief U.S. District Judge William P. Chip Johnson says the limits were unconstitutional. That means the $11,000 limit for gubernatorial candidates and $5,500 limits for other candidates and county parties will be stricken from the state's 2009 Campaign Reporting Act. The decision comes in response to a lawsuit filed by the Republican Party of New Mexico challenging the constitutionality of those and other donation limits. Judge Johnson upheld the $27,000 contribution limit from individuals and entities to state political parties. In his ruling, the judge leaned on his interpretation of the Campaign Reporting Act's original intent, which the ruling states was to address, quote, quid pro quo corruption and the appearance of corruption associated with large campaign contributions, end quote. Judge Johnson says the limits he struck down were too far removed from the concern of corruption between donors and candidates. The New Mexico Public Education Department has a new pilot program at a dozen schools around the state meant to keep kids in school and cut down on expulsions. The philosophy is called restorative justice. For our first segment of the podcast this week, executive producer Jeff Proctor talks with Emma Green, the coordinator in charge of the new program for PED, and Tripp Jennings, executive director of New Mexico In-Depth, a publication that's been following this plan for months now. The two explain the new approach to school discipline is rooted in addressing harm and communicating together. In a follow-up story published today, Monday, New Mexico In-Depth reported the number of schools participating in the program has now doubled to 24 for the coming school year. Here's Jeff.
Emma, Tripp, thank you both for joining me on New Mexico in Focus today. So we're going to talk all about today a concept called restorative justice and what that means in the classroom in New Mexico. But I like to begin with a little bit of history, right? Emma, can you describe what school discipline has meant in our schools historically in New Mexico and what it was supposed to accomplish? What has discipline looked like in the past?
Absolutely. So it's not unique to New Mexico, but nationwide, we really have had a zero tolerance approach to discipline, meaning for even minor infractions, students are sent out of the classroom, sent out of the school, sent out of the district. And so it's really exclusionary based consequences. And most of the philosophy comes from a book that was written in the 1970s called Assertive Discipline. And so it's really about that top-down the teachers is always right, and it doesn't matter how you feel as a student, even if you feel disrespected, you are to fall in line. And what we've seen is zero tolerance, while maybe well-intended, had a lot of negative unintended consequences, really targeting negatively, disproportionately, our marginalized students the most.
Have those approaches been effective? Have there been any sort of positives from your perspective about that old model of sort of suspension, expulsion, that kind of discipline?
Sure. I mean, I think in the severe cases when somebody is, at risk of harming themselves or others, then there does need to be kind of a physical separation. But really, those are for really extreme cases. And so what we see now, even the minor cases, the non-extreme cases, tend to be this kind of like a broad stroke of zero tolerance.
Sort of the old, if you are a hammer, every problem looks like a nail type of thing.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, I mean, nationally and state, we have our Guns Free Act, which does require a student to be removed from school for no less than a year. And so sometimes cases like that, then the assertive discipline model, the kind of traditional punitive exclusionary discipline models, tend to have their place.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of those consequences that we've seen from the old model. So Trip New Mexico In-Depth published a story back in December by journalist Bryant Furlow, in which you all took a pretty deep look at discipline in one district in Gallup-McKinley. That is the school district nationally that has the highest enrollment of Native students. What did Bryant find?
So, this was it's a month-long investigation that we did with our partner ProPublica, a nonprofit out of New York City. And what we did, we did not identify Gallup-McKinley at the start. We looked at PED data and discipline data, and the data took us to, we learned that indigenous students are more harshly disciplined at much greater rates than any other group in New Mexico. And then we began to look to see why that was, and it led us to Gallup-McKinley, which is a very large district. It's twice the size of Delaware. It's very rural, has frontier, and a very high Navajo population, as I recall. And they were driving the harsh discipline of indigenous students. What we did was we looked at the data, we analyzed the data, we went double-checked the data, triple-checked the data, tried to talk to the school system, and then we published our story. And what we found was a lot of what Emma was talking about, which was, in one case, there was a 13-year-old student, Matthew.
Identified as Matthew.
Matthew. We didn't identify him as his last name, but Matthew, who, was written up on several, I think it was probably disorderly conduct charges, which gluing a chair, knocking on a principal's window and running away. And what we found was from national experts is, disorderly conduct is this catch-all. And that's where you see the racial disparities.
Sort in the zero. Intentionally vague, right?
Yeah, intentionally vague. This is where you get the zero tolerance. And this is where you see the racial disparities of more indigenous students, greater rates of harsh discipline than maybe white students. Mm-hmm. I think Hispanic students, they're so small in Gallup-McKinley, there were similar rates, but statistically it was hard to, it's when you have a very small group, it's, I don't want to say statistically insignificant, but it was really, they have a very large indigenous population.
So what happened to Matthew? Can you talk about what some of the consequences were for that particular student as a result of these harsh discipline policies?
Yeah, it was a progressive kind of thing. The first time, maybe suspended for a day. Second day, maybe suspended for a week. By the, maybe several disorderly conduct, write-ups later, it was an expulsion. Mm-hmm. And that was for the rest of the year. And, Matthew, we talked to his grandmother as well. Matthew had been diagnosed with, attention deficit disorder. His grandmother was undergoing cancer treatments. There was a lot of stuff going on in his life that I think, as a parent of a child, and I know teachers can talk to this, but I think when a lot of stuff is going on at home, it's difficult in the classroom. So he was expelled. And we talked to Matthew and his grandmother over several months and got this story. And he was the way, you know, he was the personal story that wrapped around this data that we saw in Gallup-McKinley.
So let's pivot. Let's start to talk about something that's maybe a bit more hopeful with just a little bit more context in advance, right? It is almost always true that a bold idea or concept like restorative justice tends to follow something that's not working in a larger system, a failure somehow. So Emma, what is restorative justice like philosophically in the school's context, and how is it different from what we've just been sitting here talking about?
Sure, thanks. That's a great question, and I think it is really important to back up and kind of look at what it is and what it isn't. Like you said, bold ideas come with a lot of baggage, and that includes, you know, criticisms and critiques, which is fine. But really, restorative justice in the context of education is a philosophical shift away from that zero tolerance, exclusionary, traditional punitive model, and a shift, when possible, towards accountability-based consequences. And so some of the criticism that I hear is, oh, these kids are just left, you know, with a slap on the wrist or a hug and a lollipop and then handed back to class. And that's absolutely not true. So really, restorative justice and restorative practices in education, when possible, seeks to ask four questions. What was the harm? Who caused the harm? Who was harmed? And how do we make it right? And so, like we spoke of a minute ago with Guns Free Act and things like that, you know, we can't always come and circle up and ask those four questions, but a lot of the times we can. And so really what it does is it centers the people who were involved in the harm, and it honors their humanity and really centers relationships first, saying instead of a rule was broken, some relationship was harmed. So even in like classroom behavior management, if we've got, you know, a kiddo who's constantly on his phone or her phone and has been asked multiple times not to and is breaking kind of the classroom agreement of no phones, the harm that's being caused there is this teacher's trying to teach, right? And other students in the class are trying to learn. And so that can be a good opportunity to say, what was the harm? Who was harmed? Who did the harm, and how do we make it right?
So what does that look like mechanically? If I were to come and visit a school where this is happening, what would I see?
So it depends on when you visit the school in the timeline of implementation. So I really want to make it clear to folks that this is not an event. It is a process as far as implementing restorative and making that shift from our exclusionary to our restorative. And so it takes about 3 to 5 years to make that shift. So if you entered into a school that is maybe in their first year of implementing, you'll see a lot of community building talking circles, checking in the morning, even asking, like, on a scale of fist to five, fist meaning you're a zero and not feeling very good, five being like best day ever, let's just do a quick check-in. And you know, some kiddos don't feel like sharing why. So it's just, it's okay to say, like, just show me a number. Because if you've got a kiddo who's like, I'm five, and then they're coming to school and they're like, I'm a zero, I'm a one, it's not groundbreaking information necessarily, but it's a good cue to know something's going on there. Something might be going on at home. Our kids are the canaries in a coal mine, right? So when they start exhibiting behaviors that are perceived as negative, it might be something that's happening at home. It might be the culture and climate and community that they're in their learning environment.
So Bryant did a follow-up story for New Mexico in depth on this restorative justice approach and a pilot program that I know you're involved with the public education department. What is that program and how were the schools chosen?
Perfect. That I can speak to quite easily. So the pilot program is called the Prevention, Response, and Resiliency Program. And we were able to bring 12 schools into our first year cohort. They are cohort number one. They're getting ready to move into their second year as the school year kicks off. And they were chosen based on a competitive application process where a review committee reviewed their applications. We had a scoring rubric on who scored the highest around like their readiness, their level of buy-in, not only personally to implementing, but also kind of the level of buy-in maybe among staff and admin. And so we got 36 applications in our first year, which I thought was pretty good. And we were able to take 12 due to funding and budgetary and personal capacity limitations. But I am happy to say that we not only got renewed funding for this school year we're about to go into, but increased funding. So I'm able to still continue to support my original 12 schools that make up cohort one. We're about ready to open the application window again for a new cohort, cohort two, to come in. It'll be 12 more schools, and same process, competitive application process, graded with a rubric. And I'm really happy to say that out of the 60 people that are cohort one, we've got 6 or 7 students, which is really important to me. You know, our education system is supposed to be for our students, but yet they're conspicuously missing from the design.
Mm-hmm. Tripp, I want to go back to you briefly. When Bryant pitched this, the follow-up story about the restorative justice work, what, from your perspective as an editor and publisher, made that a New Mexico in-depth story? Why did you want to publish that story? What was important about it to you?
You know, I'm going to handle the Bryant part of the question because he was doing the reporting, and what he was being told at Gallup-McKinley was that the high expulsion rates, the high discipline rates, were due to high poverty, hunger, all this kind of stuff. So they began looking around and they found districts where you had the same demographic population, high poverty, a lot of hunger, and there wasn't this expulsion, harsh discipline. And that led him down, like, why is that? He found that restorative justice in Cuba independent schools, Cuba and Gallup-McKinley were identified in a report like a dozen years ago by the Center on Law and Poverty as having really a big problem. And today, Gallup-McKinley still has a high expulsion rate. Cuba, not so much, because they're actually doing some of this talking circles in the restorative justice. Part of the reason that it interests me as someone who's been around, you know, these kinds of subjects for a long time. I mean, I ran into restorative justice first in the criminal justice world. I saw the punitive measures that you could see. I was in California when 3 strikes, you're out, you know, started. But mainly it was this kind of moral question, which is like, restorative justice seems to be more communal than individualistic. That's how I would put it. You know, that's lay speak, you know.
I agree with that.
Yeah. So that. More communal, and it's about this sociological phrase that I like, this universe of obligation. What do we owe people in our community? And it's about relationships. And I think sometimes these are really important questions that journalists, educators, philosophers, policymakers should be asking right now. And I think that's really at the heart. I could talk all day, as you know, indeed, about this kind of stuff, but I'll stop there.
The idea of sorting harm, too, really, really sits with me. Sorting and trying to make something right that was wrong. We could sit here and talk all day about it.
And we have sometimes.
But let's, indeed. Let's return to some of the criticism that you mentioned earlier of this approach, right? And I'm going to read a quote from Bryant's story from Rod Montoya, who's a state rep, Republican state rep from Farmington. This is what he said for that story. He said, quote, "Restorative justice means no consequences. Teachers are not psychologists," unquote. Is he right?
Teachers are not psychologists, but luckily we're not asking them to be. And I would say he's wrong in the no consequences. I have done over 300 talking circles, some that were just community building and some that were actually what we call tier three, like a harm was caused and we need to figure out how to make it right. And I have never seen more accountability in any human than when somebody understands that they harmed somebody else, that maybe they didn't really realize the ripple effect of their action. They might think, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm suspended from school. So they think that was the ripple effect. It started and stopped with me. No. Well, you know, mom had to take time off of work to come down here and even have this conversation with me and you kiddo right now. And so really trying to understand the ripple effects of one's actions. And what I love about it is we're teaching empathy, we're teaching perspective taking, we're teaching self-management. We're trying to build better citizens for our future, right? I mean, if that's not what education is for, then I don't know what it's for.
You use the word accountability instead of the word consequence, which I find incredibly interesting. And I want to ask one more question about this approach. As schools adopt this and your pilot program expands and maybe PED takes on a little bit more of this, should we expect this as a total replacement for the system that existed before? Does this process, this philosophy, apply to every time a kid misbehaves in school?
No, it doesn't. There are some of those cases, like I spoke about at the beginning of the show, around the Guns Free Act, and really each district gets to make their own decisions on how much or how little they want to adopt this. It's not a state statute, it's not a national mandate, and really what me and my program and my colleagues in the cohort are doing are illustrating that it's effective. We're always collecting data, and so we also know that it takes 3 to 5 years to see that data even shift. So my scope of work is simple but not easy. It's to reduce suspensions and expulsions and increase academic achievement and attendance by way of restorative justice practices and other trauma-informed and trauma-responsive practices. And so I don't think it's ever a good idea to start something new by completely throwing away what's been around, right? So I think it is a shift, slowly.
So you answered half of my last question, which is when should we start to expect to see whether this is having an effect. I want to ask the other half of the question, though. How will we know if this is working?
Sure. That's a great question. And, I really hope to be able to illustrate the effectiveness through data that we're collecting so that hopefully we can show comparison data to the schools that are doing restorative, to the schools in the state that are not. That's one way. We can look at our suspensions and expulsion rates. We can look at our academic achievement and attendance rates. We can look at graduation rates. And those are easily quantifiable. But some of the more important data that's harder to quantify is there a sense of belonging in my classroom, in my school, in my district, on my campus? Do you feel safe, supported, seen, heard, valued, validated as a student and as a staff? Because our safe, supportive, and healthy learning environments are also safe, supportive, and a healthy workplace.
Emma Tripp, thank you both a ton for coming down to talk to me today.
Thank you.
Thank you to Emma Green and Tripp Jennings for having that conversation with us. Now, this past week on New Mexico in Focus marked the first show since longtime host Gene Grant moved on to a new opportunity, working for Animal Protection of New Mexico. We wish Gene the best and we will miss him, as we know many of you will. But we are excited about the future of New Mexico in Focus, so much so that we wanted to keep you informed on where we plan to take the show from here. That's why last week on the show, I sat down with executive producer Jeff Proctor to talk about our continued commitment to local and state issues and what to expect from us moving forward. Now, obviously, Gene's departure is a massive loss. We know that. He contributed so much to this station and to the larger New Mexico community during his 18 years on air, and really hasn't sunk in completely yet, has it?
I don't think so. I mean, Gene Grant has been part of the media landscape here since I was a baby journalist. I first met him when he was still writing a column at the Albuquerque Tribune. He later went on to write a column at the Albuquerque Journal when I was working there. And of course, I was a guest on this show and sometimes correspondent on this show for a long time before I came to work here. So Gene has been this sort of omnipresent guy in the mix in journalism here for a really long time. And it's gonna be really difficult to imagine this show or kind of our profession, our industry in the state without him.
Yeah, you're right. And I know I've mentioned this on our podcast too, but I mean, every time I talk about NMPBS or bring it up, the first thing I hear is Gene Grant, Gene Grant, Gene Grant. And I know that's not going away anytime soon. And there's no replacing him. But for that reason, we're going to make some structural changes to how we present the show.
Yeah, so a little bit about that. The first thing I want to say is just to acknowledge what Gene did so well, right? He came from that talk radio tradition. He was so good at those kitchen table conversations. Let's get together and sort out our differences. He was really good at getting somebody to help formulate an opinion out loud. And he really knew when to insert his own and when not to. That said, I'm not sure we could do what he did without him. So we've made a decision that we are going to formally end what we used to call the line, which was the opinion panel that took place at this table with Gene hosting. So that will be one structural change. Of course, that doesn't mean that there won't be panel discussions, conversations around this table. But I think one of the things we really want to do and have already started to do is to have those conversations be a little less opinion focused and a little more focused around subject matter expertise. So I think that's one change that we've started to make that viewers can expect will continue.
Great. And I know we have some other new ideas and concepts that we're trying to roll out here. What else can viewers expect, at least in the short term?
In the short term, for sure, I think people are going to see a lot of faces. And I mean in the interviewer chair, right? And in the chair you're in now. I think that we'll spread the wealth and try to get a variety of voices in here in terms of the journalists who are producing the show that we make every week. So I think you'll probably see more one-on-one interviews, more one-on-two interviews, and probably some guest hosting, things like that, and definitely those roundtable conversations that viewers have come to expect from this show with just a little bit sharper focus.
And I know environmental journalism, obviously, it's a huge part of our coverage with Laura Paskus's great work over the last few years, and that's not going to change, is it?
The only way I think it's going to change is to continue to get better, right? Which is what Laura's journalism has always done. We've been friends and I've been a fan of her work for a long time. I just want to make this one sort of comment about Laura. Bill Graham, the concert promoter, used to say about the Grateful Dead, they are not the best at what they do. They're the only ones who do what they do. And as far as I'm concerned, that's Laura. There isn't another one of those in the country.
Yeah, and we saw that recently with her coverage of the fire in Albuquerque at that plastics facility. She was the first one on that. Source New Mexico obviously has done some good work since then. And we have an episode coming up next week, a special episode from Laura.
We do. So Laura has been really interested for a long time in a private company called Holtec plans to basically dump nuclear waste into the ground in southeastern New Mexico. One of the big advocates in the state for that project, a guy named John Heaton. Laura's been trying to talk to him for a really long time. He agreed to a lengthy interview with her. The show will be sort of built around that with a number of other elements, and viewers can expect that to be the rock solid accountability and explanatory journalism that Laura's always presented.
Yeah, it really is an interesting interview. And like you said, no one else has spoken to this guy yet. So we're excited to see that. And we've obviously all gotten to know Laura and her work quite well over the last few years. But who else can viewers expect to see bringing in new stories to our air?
We'll definitely be leaning on the correspondents who have helped to make this show awesome through the years. That's going to include Antonia Gonzalez, Russell Contreras, and Gwyneth Doland. I also think you can expect to see some new faces. Since Gene's announcement, I've certainly had a lot of people express interest in coming in to help us, at least in the short term. We don't have a great picture of what that's going to look like yet, but again, I think folks can expect to see a lot of new faces on the show.
Community coverage, that's always been a mandate here at NMPBS, but we really want to make sure that this show feels like it's about and for all New Mexicans. To make everyone feel like their voices are being heard. How can we do that more effectively?
Well, that's an internal conversation. Obviously, you and I are talking about this kind of all the time. We're talking about that with other folks at the station. We're talking to our sources about that. We're talking to our friends about that. That said, I don't think we have the market cornered on how to effectively do that. So I'm going to ask that people who are watching this show help us with that. Give us a call, give us an email, come to the station, tell us what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, what you want this show to reflect. This is public broadcasting at the end of the day, right? It doesn't belong to us. It belongs to the people who live in this state. So I'm hoping they can help us continue that real focus on the community.
The public broadcasting thing, that's something that Gene always said, and I know that he was really great with responding to viewers and viewers reaching out to him. He'd always talk about that. So yes, we definitely want to encourage everyone to do that, and to either Jeff or I, reach out, tell us what's going on. We're happy to communicate with you guys and talk about that. And Jeff, thanks so much. Looking forward to the future.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Lou. Yeah.
Thank you, as always, for listening to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast this week. Be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, August 21st, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.